So the theme for the talk this evening is looking for definition. And in case you don't know what that word means, definition in English is to draw a line around something, to define it, drawing a line around it. And it seems a very natural human curiosity to want to seek for the definition of who we are. It seems a very natural thing, and when we come here on retreat, we find we may be asking ourselves this question. But too often in our lives, we can make a fundamental error and keep looking for that definition in the wrong places. Sometimes we settle for a definition that either somebody gives us or we find ourselves, and we believe it. We start to believe that's the truth of who I am, and we start to fall asleep behind it. And we fall more and more deeply asleep behind this definition, all the time never quite convinced this is really who I am, but settling for it because at least it's a definition. And people say to us, we've heard the voices from the outside, you've got to be somebody. You've got to be somebody. And you think, okay, I've got to be somebody. And you look at yourself and think, okay, how do I do that? And then we create a pressure as we grow up in order to try and find, who is this somebody I'm supposed to be? And even if we feel we've rejected the social conventions of the outer voices of becoming something, we may have them in ourselves anyway. Even if we've adopted a countercultural definition, this is still a definition. There's a story of a man, and some of you wonder what this word insight means, and if you've had any yet. And there's the story of this prisoner who was learning this form of meditation in the States. And they taught him the practice 1 week, and he was asked to go and practice during the week and come back and report the following week. And he came back and he said, he was really excited. He said, you know rain? And they said, yes, yes, I know rain. He said, it's not just rain, it comes in drops. And this for him was seeing beyond the appearance of something he'd always lived with as the truth, that rain was just this thing, and he looked more clearly and he saw into it a little bit deeply, a little bit more deeply. And that's sometimes what we, well, very much what we need to do in this practice. We have the view, yes, I'm this, I'm that, I'm the other thing. And in this practice, we can look beyond that to see and actually wake up with the joy, ah, maybe that's not the whole truth of who I am. Behind this search, when the search is directed in the wrong direction, behind this search is an assumption. Like he had the assumption about rain looking a certain way, we have this assumption, which you may have noticed, that there is someone, somebody, some separate defined thing called me. It looks that way. It certainly looks that way. And that's the appearance, and that's the appearance we're here to look into. When you know, you might notice or consider how this all begins, this way of finding these wrong definitions. And as a child, you know, consider yourself as a child born into this world. Those definitions and labels aren't quite so important then. They really don't hold the same weight as they do when we become adults and we stick behind them. Children seem to have more important things to do, like playing and exploring the world with their senses. And they get initiated into this world of needing to be somebody quite early. And I remember for myself being about 5 years old on a camping holiday. And I was playing with this girl and she was about 8. So I assumed she was wiser. And we were doing gymnastics together, turning cartwheels and running around. And then she came up and she stopped and looked very serious at me. And she said, I'm a Roman Catholic. What are you? And I remember this mixture of horror that clearly whatever was behind her question, it was important to her. I had no idea why. But there was this horror that if I didn't have the right answer, if I didn't match that with equally as good a definition, then I would have nobody to play with. And a Roman Catholic, it sounded so important, you know. I knew that we were Catholics because I went to a Catholic school and a Catholic church, but I didn't think we were Roman Catholics. That sounded so much more grand, and I had an image, and I remember Romans. Oh, the guys with the metal skirts. And I thought, no, I haven't seen any of those. I can't be a Roman. I mustn't be. So there was fear. And I remember running back to my mum and saying into the tent, Mum, are we Roman Catholics? And she said, yes. And I thought, oh. And I remember there was that relief. There was a relief. Oh, I could match her now. I could match her. I had this label. But there was also this bewilderment, this, why? Why is this important? And I remember seeing that and being initiated into the world of adulthood, where it does become so important to us. And because it seems so important to everybody that we have and we know who we are, because they seem to know who they are, all those other ones, they seem to know, they've got their labels together and they know clearly who they are, so I must do. I must be the only one that hasn't got one. I better find one. And as a child, we start to collect them. And you see children do it a little bit more fluidly. They try on one identity and put it off, and try on another one and take it off. And they're more fluid with it. But they're still practicing to try to become one of those things. And around the dinner table at home, there was all this talk of the family members. Uncle Dick's married to Auntie Mary, and he's the second cousin by marriage. And I was hearing all these grand names. Oh, he's one of those. He's one of those. And then I remember always asking the question, so what does that make me? So what does that make me? And they'll say, you know, oh, you're a second cousin once removed. And that would be great. Oh, now I know. I'm a second cousin once removed. So you go to school the next day and you say, guess what? I'm a second cousin once removed. And in this way, we start to see and start to believe in these importance of these labels. But that question, so what does that make me? That's a question that, unexamined, we live with it and we start looking at our world with those eyes. And I wonder if you've noticed it at all here on the retreat. You know, there's that thing, okay, this is this and this is the break. So what does that make me? You know, where am I in all of this? And that question, that it's so directed. We want to know, there's a natural curiosity, but it's so much directed at, what's in this for me? What's in this for me? Who am I in all of this? And so the world gets underway with these definitions, with these identities of what I am, what is mine, and what is me. And then what starts to happen, we lose the fluidity of the child who can just take them on and off, and we start to believe them. We start to believe them as the whole truth of who I am. And this is where we start to suffer. Even if intellectually we might know, yes, I know I'm not just a wife and just a meditator and just this, I know that. But do we really know it fully, that the label, the role can be on and then it can be off, and it can be as fluid as it needs to be? So the being, our being, can fall more and more deeply asleep behind these definitions. Why? Why do we do this? It seems sometimes that it's so much easier to go to sleep behind the definitions than to keep that question alive. Who am I? Who am I really? That the sleep is preferable to the search. And these labels, it's not all bad news with the labels. They have a use. They have a use. You know, if you're a school teacher, it's really useful to know you're a school teacher, because then you'll get up in the morning and go to school. It's useful. It has a place and a context in time and with an agreement. Ah, okay, and we remember to use it wisely. But there is a great difference between entering that role wholeheartedly, the mother, the wife, the teacher, the meditator, entering it wholeheartedly and believing it to be who I am. There is a big difference. There is a big difference. And what we find is, if we can actually be more fluid with these identities, not actually taking them as the whole truth, we can then be freed up to be in it wholeheartedly. So in this practice, we're not trying to become a blob of no definite, of nothingness. We're not trying to become a blob of nothingness just sort of on a compost heap. This is not the intention at all. So if we have these roles, these labels, these definitions, to take it on wholeheartedly when we're in it, but to know when its time and place is there and when its time and place is not there. And never being made to go asleep by the illusion that this is the whole truth. So here we have all these roles. There's the meditators, there's the managers, there's the teachers. And this is an agreement that we make for these days, that we take on these roles. On one level we can look at it, we don't carry these roles with us wherever we go. I don't carry this role back to my father and say, Dad, sit down, pay attention, and tell me what's going on. So if I did, it wouldn't be appropriate. It wouldn't be the role. But what happens is, sometimes we do that, not in such gross ways, but we do it where we're still attached to those roles. And we feel that something is lacking when we're not in them. So on one level on the retreat, there's the coming together of these roles that we take on and take off at the end of the retreat. Even the definition of the retreat. Is that a absolutely true, defined phenomena? What is the retreat, actually? You know, it starts on a certain day, ends on a certain day. It's the hall, it's the people, it's the sweat, it's the instructions. Which piece has that identity that defines it separate from everything else? As a retreat. Where's the one thing that says this is a retreat? It's a collection, a coming together based in time and agreement. So if we can put down these definitions, these roles, these labels, these things that we take on, if we can put them down, then there will be no need to have to feel that we've lost something when we're not in that role, because we were never holding on to it in the first place as the truth of who I am. Have you noticed at all in the days here where you may be asking, well, where am I in all of this? Where's me? Have you noticed at all where we seek for that definition in and amongst the retreat? Not necessarily in a role, but in seeking the definition of a reflection from someone else who just confirms, oh, okay, this is who I am, the one that they smile at, or the one that they don't smile at. Are we looking at all, seeking that definition outside of ourselves? And some of the problem with the seeking, and when we think we've found one, some of the suffering in this world arises. We think we found it, we hold on to it, we believe it, and then we need to defend it. Then we need to defend it. Because if we believe this to be the truth of who I am, or I'm attached to this definition in some way, if somebody else threatens that definition, saying, oh, you're not really a teacher, what are you doing up there? You know, then... we will feel like we've fallen down from something. If we had believed, this is who I am. So we need to defend it. Sometimes with those labels and definitions, we even fight for it. And these small examples are no different from the larger examples in our world of where we fall asleep behind the definitions. So where do we take our definition? Where do we seek this definition that may not be the whole truth? We do it in roles, the role of, like I've described already, or our job. I'm the nurse, I'm the doctor, I'm the computer analyst, I'm this, I'm that. We also take a definition in our tendencies. You know, we observe tendencies arising in ourselves and we think, oh, this must be who I am. You know, you might have a tendency to be someone who cares a lot for people. Oh, I'm the caring type. This is who I am, I'm the caring type. Or I'm the really hopeless type, you know. Or whatever it might be in the tendencies that arise, I'm really the angry type. We can take this definition in our views and our opinions. We might have a view, an opinion about something, and we can start to fall asleep behind that, as if that is the truth. Ah, I have a view and opinion that this is the way things should be. This is even if it's a noble view and opinion, it might be a very wise view and opinion. But if we're holding on to that view and opinion, like, I have a view and opinion that it should be a certain way in the meditation hall. It should be quiet. Nobody should come in and out. Nobody should have a beeping watch. And this is the view and opinion that I hold to. I hold it tightly. What happens when people walk in and out? It's not quiet. The watch beeps. It kind of, that thing that we're attached to, that definition, it starts to worry us. We start to be disturbed because we were holding on. So why is this created? Why is this created where we don't see into something fully? You know, why did it take that man so long to see that rain falls in drops? And in these teachings, this not seeing, the word for it, avidya, is not seeing clearly. It's not seeing clearly the truth. And this is what we're here to do. Then we also take definitions in labels of ourselves that either come from the outside or the inside. Especially if somebody tells us it enough times, they define us and we kind of give them the power, or we allow that to be our definition. They tell us many times, oh, you're lovely. Oh, okay, I'm lovely. That's who I am. Mm-hmm. And they tell us that enough times, we might start to believe, oh, okay, then I'm lovely. Or if the voice is negative from the outside, you're useless. I'm useless. And then we start to take on these external definitions and to believe them. What happens then sometimes, very often, our senses, our eyes and our ears, we become primed, ready for a confirmation of that label. I'm just almost waiting for someone. And then we open our eyes in the meditation. You know, somebody may have told us in our life we were useless. Open our eyes in the meditation hall. Everybody else is sitting like a Buddha apart from me. And our senses are primed. We're primed. Oh, see? I'm useless. My mother was useless. My father was useless. And if you look at that photograph of my grandfather, he looks really useless. And then we build this solidity around that label. It could be a negative one, like I'm useless, I'm hopeless. Even the positive ones, that, you know, we have a mixture. We don't always just have one. We have a mixture of them. Even if it's a positive one, you're lovely. If we sit here long enough believing that, we soon find that very unsatisfactory. Even a lovely definition is so dull that we think there must be something more to this than just these labels and these names and these things that I am or I'm not. Oh, there could be the other definition in meditation, very common, that arises. I'm somebody who knows. I like to find out about life, fine. And if I don't know, then I find out. And then we come into the meditation hall and we realize that we don't know. And that actually what we're asked to embrace here is a whole body of not knowing. And if we're at all attached to that definition of myself as the one who knows, the one that needs to know, then we feel shaken. The ground of who we think we are is shaken from under our feet here in this practice of paying attention. And that's okay. That's okay. Because that's what it is to see through. It shakes us first, or else we won't let go. Or we take definition in our mind states: angry, laid back, intense, controversial, the joker, whichever kind of mind state or persona we can take on. And what happens in the meditation hall? We might have come in thinking, oh, I'm a really laid back person, and so this will really suit me. And we come into the meditation hall and we see everything but laid backness. We see intensity and drama. Hold on, this isn't who I was. Who's this? Who's this one? Or we think we're the very dramatic, intense person, and we come into the meditation and we see quietness. And we think, hey, that's not who I am. I would rather at least have the definition I had before and know than have this ground shaken from under my feet. There was, when I was a new yogi, sitting in a retreat, I remember sitting behind this one man who I knew was an experienced yogi. So I thought he was wiser. and he was sitting in front of me, and I was behind, and I saw his shoulders doing this during the sitting, like this. And I thought, wow. Wow. I thought, wow, maybe I'll get to that one soon. And I thought, that maybe that's, you know, some esoteric thing I'll find out on the next retreat. And then I had the good fortune to be in a small group with him. And he goes, you know, I don't know what's going on. I am such a serious person, but I can't stop laughing. I'm in the meditation hall and I can't stop laughing, but I'm a serious person. What's going on? And in this way, we soon see in the meditation hall, we can't live under those illusions anymore, any of them. This one, I'm this one, I'm this one. They all have the possibility of arising. Are we one of them, two of them, all of them, none of them? We could take identity in what we did do or what we didn't do in the past. Oh, I did that in the past, or I didn't do that in the past. And we can drag that with us. Drag it with us and carry it with us if we haven't fully seen into it. So why do we do this? Why do we do this? And we might think, oh yes, I would love to let go of these limited definitions and discover the truth of who I am. That sounds great. And you might say, yes, yes. And I would love not to make my home in an illusion of playing cards stacked up that will be doomed to fall down. But do you really? But do you really? If it means that all the cherished views about myself and the world the rug gets pulled out from under your feet, then do you still want to know the truth of who you are? We don't want to let go very often. We don't want to let go. And there's a story of a man who comes to the edge of the cliff, and he falls off the cliff, and he's holding onto a tree by one branch, and he was an atheist all his life until that moment. And he's holding onto the tree, and he says, God, God, if you're there, if there is a God, please save me, please save me. And this voice booms from the valley, huh, that's what they all say. And he says, no, this time really I will believe in you if you save me. And he says, no, I've heard that one before. And he goes, God, really, this time, I promise. And God says, okay, let go of the branch. And he goes, let go of the branch? Do you think I'm crazy? And that's sometimes what it's like. It feels like to let go of any of those things. So in that question, what does it give to me? We hold on because it seems to give something to me. And there's this me that everyone tells me exists and I think exists as a separately defined thing. And it seems at least to give me something that I can make a home. You know, this definition that I carry with me, at least I know that. And there feels to be a safety in that familiarity. But it's so limited. And it is not true. And in what appears to us sometimes like this huge world that's so difficult in some way, so chaotic, so unknown, and then there's me and there's this huge big world, at least if I have some little definition I can hold on to, then it doesn't seem so bad out there. If you're asking me not to have any, what does that make me in all of this big thing? And then on retreat we start to have glimmers or moments or notice some silence, even just for a moment. Some stillness, some quietness might happen. And even if it's what we've yearned for the first 3 days, there might be a moment of it. And at first, oh, great, silence. And then what happens? if the encouragement is to let go into that, what sometimes starts to happen is that we seek after some definition of myself within it. There's this silence, this empty space for just a moment where nobody seems to be defining me. Nothing's coming from the outside, nothing's coming from the inside. Who am I in that moment? And we might see ourselves searching in the contents of our mind. Oh, now I'm the silent one. And we see that, oh, there's a new definition. I'm the silent one. And what we notice in those moments, in that moment of any of those letting goes, whether it's in quiet or not in quiet, there is that sense, that intimation in that quietness that maybe there's something else to discover about the truth of who I am. And in that moment when there's no definition happening, no obvious definition happening, there's this, sometimes fear arises that maybe, how would it be the possibility, the thing I've always suspected all along, that maybe nobody's home. And the thought I, arising from the fear, the thought I arises, no, and of course there's somebody home. You're home. And that fear that arises, the fear of I arising in relationship to who am I, we can start to see it there. And not that nobody home is either some place to arrive at, but that any of those limited definitions, any of them, we will not find our satisfaction and our nature in them. And yogis, people on retreat, meditators have reported in meetings, they say, you know, I even prefer the negative definition of myself than to not have one at all. I even see myself in those moments of quietness clinging to a negative definition. Even though it's painful when I do that, I suffer when I do that, and all those things, I'd rather have it than this unlimited possibility. So sometimes we carry these roles and definitions as truth. And what starts to happen is we know we're holding if we feel somehow we're lacking something when those aren't there. Do we feel that we're lacking something in the moment when none of those reflections are coming? And there's a story of another meditator at Guy House, and she would be quite happy for me to tell this story. And she had been on a retreat for a month, and her husband was also on the same retreat. And at the end of the retreat, she said, I noticed this movement trying to seek for my role of wife, of lover, of partner. But actually in the silence of things, when I'm just there without that definition, the marriage or the partner or whatever, that's not the truth of that moment. Yes, she's married to him, and yes, this is an important thing to remember, and at the end of the retreat, you know, they'll go home together. But in the midst of it, does there feel like anything is truly lacking if I'm not receiving that reflection from that other person in this case? And she said what she noticed was that she got drawn every day closer towards the washing line where his laundry was hanging up. And that they wash the meditators' clothes if they're there for a long time. And that a pair of his pants were hanging on the washing line. And she said what she started to notice was there was that movement, so much wanting, yearning for that reminder of, oh yeah, this is who I am, I'm the loved wife, that she noticed, she said, I started to develop a relationship with this pair of underpants. Because that gave her a reflection. But actually, I mean, she saw and she laughed. She could see that with the humour. Oh, you know, you clearly see it's an illusion when it's a pair of underpants. but sometimes, you know, it's more painful than that. And even that seeking after, that movement of wanting, yearning in that moment, if it feels like it's lacking, it's fine. It's beautiful to have these connections. But if in that moment it isn't present, do we feel lost without it? And it could be with any role. any role, any definition, any label, any view, anything. And we feel safe. You know, there's that illusion of safety when we have the world defined, and that's what we love to do for safety. We want safety, and it seems fair enough. I want some safety. But what we carve up with a knife, we carve up the world into these little boxes. Ah, you're the one that's like this, you're the one that's like this, I'm the one that's like this. And we make these boxes and we try to draw these lines around them. Wrap up the boxes, tie them up with string, and pull a knot and hope it stays that way, because at least that way I can see what's going on. And then, either, because nature doesn't do this, nature does not draw these lines around itself. You know, Helen Keller, I think she said, security is a superstition. It is not to be found in nature. Either life is a glorious adventure or it is nothing. This security that we've made in these little boxes, we think it's the illusion of security. They're there in these boxes of what we know to be true, me, this, that. Either we get so exhausted from holding these boxes so tightly, for a while we can live in that illusion if we don't look. If we don't look, we can live in that illusion. We get so tired of that we just kind of give up. We're so exhausted of holding this all like this. Or we can just ask ourselves, there must be more than just these definitions. There must be more. It doesn't quite ring true. It doesn't ring of the whole truth. Or these boxes, we're holding them tightly and they're sort of bursting open. You know, and what I thought was that person, the one who is the really good carer, you're the really good carer, he starts to be really hopeless. And we kind of, no, you mustn't be hopeless because I have you defined this way. Please stay that way. But nature isn't like that. We're not just one thing. Sometimes when the string on those boxes starts to loosen, we start to pull tighter. And that's when we get into more struggle of needing to defend and fight for what those things. We pull the string tighter to keep it the way I see it. I don't want to be shown a new way. So these boxes pop open, or we decide to look more clearly. And what happens in this life of looking into, we start to get disillusioned. Disillusioned in its most positive sense. The illusion of these boxes, we see it's not true. So we start to be disillusioned. This isn't the way it is. I can't keep doing this. And life is just doing its dance. The illusions start to crumble. And if we don't let go of this identification, then we are bound for the rest of our lives to securing and protecting an illusion. And we have to ask ourselves sometimes, do I really want to do that with the rest of my life? Keep this illusion bound. And then we come on retreat and we hear, okay, I'm not supposed to have these outer definitions. And then we do the same process on the inside. We start to have these inside definitions of the meditator. Oh, no, okay, I'm not any of those things, I'm the meditator. Or we think we're really refined and spiritual when we say, haha, no, I'm not even the meditator. I'm the observer. And we think, oh, now I know who I am. And we think with that, and then we get even cleverer. No, I'm not the observer, I'm awareness. And we see in any of those definitions that any of those ones we take hold of is so, so unsatisfactory. It just doesn't do it, it doesn't ring true, but we might try and hold. What happens if we've stuck ourselves in these identities is that we feel bound to those identities, and we don't dare to act in other ways. You know, either from external pressure or internal pressure. You know, so if I'm in the role of the carer, and then what I start to notice is that the time has arisen in my life where I need to be taken care of. That can be so hard. that can be so hard, to just let go of that role of the carer in the moment when we're the one that needs to be cared for. Or we feel so typecast in that role from the outside that if we start to see and experience and act with this more fluid nature, then other people from the outside object. And they say, no, you stay like this. And we see that we're changing, we see that we're moving, we see that the box, the string's off the box and life is dancing. But if there's this pressure from the outside, we may be in fear of living with that integrity. And life is much more beautiful than that if we let it do its dance. That even those views of how things should be, I know my role, even if it's a righteous role, it might be the most righteous, right on, correct role. Even that one, if we believe that's the role we have to be, life doesn't see it that way. It doesn't. And if we do that, if we even stick to our righteous role, even if it's so ethically correct and principled, then life can't do its more glorious dance. And there's a story. That was a lead up to a story. Some of you will have heard this, but it's a great story. The train clanked and rattled through the suburbs of Tokyo on a spring afternoon. Our carriage was a little quite empty. There was a few housewives with their children, some old people doing shopping. I looked at the houses outside absent-mindedly. At one station, the doors of the carriage opened, and suddenly the afternoon quiet was shattered by a man shouting violent, incomprehensible curses. The man staggered into our car. He wore labourer's clothing, and he was big, he was drunk, and he was dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. The blow sent her spinning into the laps of an old couple. It was a miracle that the baby was unharmed. Terrified, the couple jumped up and scrambled towards the other end of the carriage. The labourer aimed a kick at the retreating back of the old woman, but he missed as she scuttled to safety. This so maddened the drunk that he grabbed at the metal pole in the centre of the carriage and he tried to wrench it out. I could see that one of his hands was cut and bleeding. The train lurched forward, the passengers frozen with fear. I stood up. I was young then, some 20 years ago, and in pretty good shape. I'd been putting in a solid 8 hours of Aikido training nearly every day for the past 3 years. I liked to throw and grapple. I thought I was tough. Trouble was, my martial arts skill was untested in actual combat. As students of Aikido, we are not allowed to fight. Aikido, my teacher had said again and again, is the art of reconciliation. That's making peace. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you are already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it. I listened to his words. I tried hard. I even went so far as to cross the street to avoid this must be some gang name, to avoid the people, the pinball punks who had lounged around the stations. My forbearance exalted me. I felt both tough and holy. In my heart, however, I wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity where I might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. This is it, I said to myself, getting to my feet. People are in danger, and if I don't do something fast, they will probably get hurt. Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized a chance to focus his anger. Aha, he said, a foreigner. You need a lesson in Japanese manners. I held on lightly to the commuter strap overhead and gave him a slow look of disgust and dismissal. I planned to take this turkey apart. But he had to make the first move. I wanted him mad, so I pursed my lips and blew him a kiss. All right, he hollered, you're going to get a lesson. He gathered himself for a rush at me. A split second before he could move, someone shouted, hey! It was ear-splitting. I remember strangely the joyous, lilting quality of it, as though you and a friend had been searching diligently for something and suddenly stumbled upon it. Hey! I wheeled to the left. The drunk spun to his right. We both stared down at a little old Japanese man. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no notice of me, but he beamed delightedly at the labourer as though he had a most important, most welcome secret to share. Come here, the old man said in easy language, beckoning to the drunk. Come here and talk with me. He waved his hand lightly. The big man followed, as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared at the clacking wheels, "Why the hell should I talk to you?" The drunk now had his back to me. If his elbow so much moved a millimeter, I would drop him in his socks. The old man continued to beam at the labourer, smile at the labourer. "What you been drinking?" he asked, his eyes twinkling with interest. "I've been drinking sake," the labourer bellowed back, "and it's none of your business." Flecks of spit went all over the old man. "Oh, that's wonderful," said the old man. "Absolutely wonderful. You see, I love sake too. Every night, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we warm up a little bottle of sake and we take it out into the garden and we sit on the old wooden bench. We watch the sun go down and we look to see how our persimmon tree is doing. My great-grandfather planted that tree, and we worry about whether it will ever recover from the ice we had last winter. Our tree has done better than I expected, though, especially when you consider the poor quality of the soil. It is gratifying to watch when we take our sake and go out to enjoy the evening, even when it rains." He looked up at the labourer, twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fists slowly unclenched. "Yeah," he said, "I love persimmons too." And his voice trailed off. "Yes," said the old man, "and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife." "No," replied the labourer, "my wife died." Very gently swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to cry. "I don't got no wife. Don't got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself." Tears rolled down his cheeks. A spasm of despair rippled through his body. Now it was my turn. Standing there in my well-scrubbed youthful innocence, my make this world safe for everybody, full of righteous democracy, suddenly I felt dirtier than him. Then the train arrived at my stop. As the doors opened, I heard the old man cluck sympathetically. "My, my," he said. "That is a difficult predicament indeed. Sit down here and tell me about it." I turned my head for one last look. The labourer was sprawled on the seat, his head in the old man's lap. The man was softly stroking his filthy, matted hair. As the train pulled away, I sat down on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with his kind words. I had just seen Aikido tried in combat, and the essence of it was love. I would have to practice the art with an entirely different spirit. It would be a long time before I could speak about the resolution of conflict. So if we hear that and then we think, oh, so I should be the one with the kind words. No. And then, I don't know if you want any more stories about how we suffer. It's probably enough. But there's one other one we do. You know, when we've put the definition onto somebody else, especially somebody we admire, you know, and we put somebody else onto this pedestal and we say, oh, yes, this is the embodiment of perfection. And I'm just down here. And we feel it's safer to live in our world where I'm down here and that one's up there. And we have this pedestal and we have this great love for this person, great respect for this person. And we think it's love anyway, until we see that person eat 6 chocolates all in one go. And We're so angry. They have destroyed our vision of perfection. And we're angry. And what we thought was love turns to hate. And it wasn't love at all. It wasn't love at all. And when we see that what seemed like love turns to an opposite, we might have to say, is that love? That keeping somebody in that box? So this way we do it in the small way with our labels here, small way with the labels here, it all starts in the mind. And even where we see this definition of them and us in the world, where it leads to so much pain and conflict, it starts in our minds. It doesn't start anywhere else. It starts in a human mind that doesn't look into this notion, this assumption that I am this defined, separate thing. So even if we have high ideals of love and harmony, the truth is this unexamined notion of I, this unexamined notion of myself as a separate little box of me and the world, that will lead to conflict sooner or later. So if we let go of these definitions, if we've let go of the branch of the tree in just that moment, not for the rest of the retreat, just for that moment, who are we? Who are we? When we see the limitation and the unsatisfactoriness of keeping making these definitions, when we see that and we let go, who are we? When we don't make any more card houses, construct any more illusions, we don't construct that card house anymore, who are we without constructing that? Who are we? And if we're not looking for the definition outside, we've seen that doesn't work, and we're no longer looking for the definition inside either, because we see that that doesn't work. Who are we? Who are we? And even if we see ourselves building this house of cards again, even if we see ourselves doing, oh God, there I go again, making a big definition, that's okay. We can become aware of ourselves doing it, and we might see ourselves hiding under it, falling asleep behind it. If we can see that, it starts to puncture and break up the belief in its solidity. As long as we keep alive that question, that natural curiosity, what is the truth of who I am? When I'm not looking outside and I'm not looking inside, where is the answer? Where is the answer? You can say everywhere where the answer isn't. Tell me where the answer is. And what we seek for, that understanding of our true nature, may not be as far away as we think. It may not be in the next 20 years retreat, after I've done that much practice, after I've fixed this and done that and sorted that piece out. It is closer to us than our breath. It is closer to us than our breath. So in meditation, we're not creating a new identity of being a nobody. Oh, now I'm a nobody. No. You're not a nobody either. Any place we make our home is trying to fix, and nature just doesn't do that. It just doesn't do that. It may just be that we're looking in the wrong place. And the answer may be quite simple. And this movement of looking for this definition isn't all bad news. When we seek and we're alive with that inquiry, things start to break up a little bit. We start to have glimmers. Oh, that maybe this separate, what feels so separate from these others, isn't. And we start to see that. And in those moments, the love and the connection and the compassion is naturally there. In the moments when we're not holding ourselves to be that thing, the connection happens all on its own. And yet, as we, this paradox, it seems like a paradox, as we see that more clearly, see that connection with love, that we're not so separate from all these other people, all these other beings, all this other world. At the same time, we see more and more, oh, maybe, is there really someone home? You know, maybe what we thought of someone being home isn't what we thought. And this strange paradox is held in our wisdom. It's held in the ground of our awareness, not in the mind of duality. And I finish with the quote from one great teacher who held this paradox beautifully. He said, "Wisdom tells me I am nothing, and love tells me I am everything. And between these two, my life flows." Love tells me I am everything, wisdom tells me I am nothing, and between these two, my life flows. May all beings see into their true nature.